Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today we will continue reading the April-May 2025 issue of Guideposts with articles like My Easter Stray, Animals and Healing, My Easter Stray, The Older I Got, The Harder It Was to Stop Worrying, by Lou Dean, Dinosaur, Colorado. That cold February morning, the northwest Colorado wind howled as I walked toward my barn. Mice scampered to safety when I opened the door. "You rodents are going to take over now that Two Socks is gone," I said, unable to hide my dismay. I'd lost my barn cat to a stroke in the fall. After 30 years in my rural community, I knew that getting around would be no simple task. Cats from the shelter or city-raised cats didn't stand a chance on Blue Mountain against our coyotes, bobcats, and mountain lions, not to mention the raptors overhead. "Lord," I whispered, "I need a stray cat." But where was I going to find one? My mind kicked into worry gear. I'd always had a tendency toward what my grandfather used to call borrowing trouble. To combat it, I'd made a habit of reciting Matthew 6:25. "Therefore, I tell you, do not be anxious about your life." But since I turned 75, it seemed harder to stop worrying. Topping my list was my older sister in Oklahoma. From 1,000 miles away, I'd spent months trying to help sis stay at her home. The challenge exhausted us both and finally had to admit it was time for sis to go into a nursing home, which caused me to consider my own age and circumstances. What will I do when my own health worsens? When I can no longer take care of my animals and keep up my acre here on Blue Mountain? That day seemed closer than ever. I grabbed the snow shovel from the barn. How I missed Two Socks. He had found my barn one cold winter night and ended up being my buddy for 9 years, a loyal barn cat. In exchange for a daily portion of kibble and love, he kept the mouse population down. It had taken a long time for him to trust me enough to let me pet him, but I'd patiently offered him food and waited for him to come around. One afternoon, he'd met me at the barn with a meow and allowed me to rub him behind the ears before diving into his food. That became our routine. In the 5 months since he died, I caught myself listening for the greeting every day, and my heart would ache all over again. I finished shoveling and went back in the house. That afternoon, I was sipping hot tea and watching more snow come down when I saw a flash of yellow and white disappear into the barn. For a moment, I stood disbelieving, a cat. I thought of my morning prayer and grinned. I set out bowls of food and water in the barn. The food was being eaten, but the cat remained out of sight for more than a week. I remembered how Two Socks had hidden in the attic of the barn when he first arrived. One afternoon, I took a flashlight, crawled up on the hay in the attic, and slowly scanned every inch of it. Two eyes glowed in the darkness. "Hi there," I said. The cat came into view, then sank to the floor as if hiding something. I shined the light closer. My breath caught. There were two tiny bodies squirming on the attic floor. Kittens. The cat didn't look old enough to have babies. Would they survive? I went to the vet in town and asked if I should bring the kittens down out of the attic. "With her being wild, if you do, she might move them and you won't ever see them again," the vet said. "One thing to try is to buy some canned kitten food for her. It has more protein and might help her nurse her kittens." I made many trips to the barn over the next 2 weeks, fretting over the little cat and her kittens. Mama peeked down from the attic when I put out the canned food for her. "Hey, pretty girl," I called to her. "How are those babies?" She never ventured closer. One morning, I climbed into the attic to find the babies hadn't made it through the night. From the back of the attic where I could see her, Mama let out a morning cry that broke my heart. I had to remove the kitten so she wasn't reminded of her loss. "It's okay, pretty girl," I told her. "Things will get better. You'll get through this." But she remained hidden. I buried the two tiny kittens near my flower garden and said a prayer. I wished God might somehow comfort Mama, but I worried she would vanish as suddenly as she had appeared. For days, I saw no sign of her. I called the vet for advice. "Borrow a live trap and put her food in there. Something more tempting than kibble," he said. "Let her get comfortable going in it. Then set the trap. You need to catch her and get her spayed. Otherwise, she could go into heat again and have more kittens." I put some chicken in a live trap, but she didn't touch it. A friend suggested sardines. It worked. Mama got used to going into the trap. Within a week, I was able to set it and catch her. I got my first good look at Mama. She was so small, barely a kitten herself. The vet verified my suspicion and said that's probably why the kittens didn't live. I'd say it was her first heat. She isn't more than a year old. After her operation, I took the cat back to the barn. She hadn't been really wild in the cage. She just huddled against the far side and looked terrified. "It's okay," I told her as I opened the cage door. She streaked away. Would she survive all she'd been through? Would she stay? Maybe the grief of losing her kittens in that barn would be too much. There I went, borrowing trouble again. February folded into March. I never knew for sure when I went into the barn if that cat would still be there. She hadn't made one move to get friendly. But I got into the habit of sitting on the hay and talking to her, trying to get her used to my voice and convince her that life would be better. Sometimes she'd peek at me from her safe place in the attic, but she never came down while I was around. On Easter morning, March 31st, I had plans to attend a sunrise service. I made my way to the barn in the dark to take food to her before I left. I hadn't slept well. I dished out the food, then plopped down some on the hay bales. My sister had fallen the day before and was in the hospital in Oklahoma. 1,000 miles might as well be 1,000,000, I said. What will happen to Sis? Will she ever leave the hospital? My words echoed off the cold barn walls. Then my worries gained momentum. What if I have to give up my place and move? What will happen to my animals, especially this cat? As I sat there on the hay, it struck me how foolish I sounded. "Lord," I said, "it just isn't humanly possible for me to quit this worrying. Please help me." I felt something brush against my leg. The kitty that I'd been calling Mama was at my feet, looking at me. "Hello there," I said, wiping at tears. "See how silly I am? This time 2 months ago, I was worrying that I didn't have a barn cat." The cat held my gaze. "Do not be anxious about your life," I quoted. "Meow," she agreed. But when I reached to touch her, she dashed up to the attic again. I had to chuckle at that. "I will call you Favor," I said, and the peace and joy of the season washed over me. I knew in that moment she had been sent because I needed not only a barn cat, but also a reminder not to worry. With God's grace and favor, I would be able to proceed. I would comfort Sis, take care of my animals, and enjoy my acre on Blue Mountain one day at a time. For more on this story, see Family Room. Spiritual Notebook, Tuition Miracle, I Was $594 Short, by Nikki Cooper, Plano, Texas. I sat at my kitchen table, switching between the calculator app on my phone and the email from the University of Oklahoma with the bill for my son Brecken's spring tuition. Today was Tuesday, tuition was due Friday, and I was $594 short. I counted the cash in my jar again, added that amount to what I had left in my savings account after paying his twin brother's tuition to Belmont University in Nashville 2 weeks before, went back to the calculator and crunched the numbers one more time. Still $594 short. I'd been a single mom since the boys were 6. I'd had 12 years to prepare for this, but on a teacher's salary, there wasn't much at the end of each month to stash away. I knew I'd eventually have to take out loans to get the twins through college, but I was really hoping I could at least survive the first year without doing that. Brecken and Brennan had each received government loans of $5,500 for freshman year. They used their earnings from summer jobs for spending money. The rest was up to me. I discouraged the boys from getting term time jobs. I wanted them to settle into college life and focus on their studies. I couldn't ask them to chip in now. Most of what I saved was over the past 18 months. The calculations I'd done at the start of their senior year of high school sent me into panic mode. I started advertising my services as a babysitter, tutor, and house cleaner on a local Facebook moms group. I worked as a ticket taker at sporting events at the school where I taught. Before long, I had 2 or 3 hours of side gigs lined up most nights after working my job as a 7th grade English teacher. I didn't mind. Brecken and Brennan were so busy their senior year that they were seldom home in the evenings anyway. It was a little embarrassing to tell my coworkers that I couldn't go to a happy hour on Friday afternoon because I had to babysit, and I'm sure the neighborhood teens didn't appreciate a 53-year-old poaching their prime money-making opportunities either. But I was too desperate to care. With the boys away at their colleges, I'd continued the side gigs to keep the extra cash coming in. But how was I going to tutor, babysit, and clean enough in 3 days to make almost $600? Was I really going to have to take out a loan so soon? I could ask my parents for the money. At least they wouldn't charge me interest. But I was already ashamed by now how often I'd turned to them for financial help over the past 12 years. My sister would kick in if I asked her, but a request like that would be humiliating. I was her older sister, after all. I shouldn't need her money. Defeated, I put down my phone and prayed, God, you know I can't spare $600 from my checking account right now. I'd never make it to the end of the month. If I need to borrow the money, make it clear to me how to do that. If there's a way to earn it in time, show me. I'm not asking for a miracle, but I could really use a hint about what I should do. Please grant me some clarity. That was the best I could do for now. I'd have to carry on with my day and wait for an answer to come. Tomorrow was trash day, so it was time to take the bin to the curb. I rolled it down to the driveway, then checked my mailbox. I sifted through the usual bills and junk ads. Among them, an envelope from my mortgage company caught my eye. Oh no, I thought, what is this? I was enrolled in the company's paperless billing program. I was certain I'd made the most recent house payment online. Had some kind of technical glitch caused it to not go through? Would there be a late fee? Back in the kitchen, I sank into my seat and opened the envelope. It wasn't a late notice at all. It was a check. The escrow account had funds remaining after my property taxes had been paid, and the mortgage company was sending me the balance, $585.09. That was only $9 short of what I needed to pay Brecken's tuition. $9. Yeah, I could totally swing that. I'm not the kind of girl who says it's a God thing every time something good happens to me. Likewise, I don't blame God or say it's His will when bad things happen. I typically have the mindset that even though God loves me, heaven is heaven, earth is earth, and earth is where the bad stuff happens. If it didn't, it would be heaven. I think that, for the most part, God lets us fight our way through this muck, but the promise of a perfect place is our reward someday. But between the timing of my prayer and receiving almost the exact amount I needed, well, I find it hard not to declare it divine intervention. As I sat there in astonishment, I felt God say to me, "You worked hard. You did all you could. I took care of the rest. Didn't you trust me?" I guess I didn't. But since then, another semester's tuition for the boy has come due, and I've once again somehow managed to pay for it without having to borrow a dime. I know now that whatever I need, big or small, I never have to be embarrassed about asking God to see me through. Earth is where the good stuff happens, too. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access it anytime, on demand, at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guideposts magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guideposts' other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. Story of a Song, One Day at a Time, by Pat Butler Dyson, contributing writer. Cruising around Nashville in her Cadillac that day in 1973, Mary Jean Wilkin should have been on the top of the world. She'd made a name for herself writing and publishing hundreds of successful country songs. But at 53, depressed by the failure of her third marriage, Wilkin found herself seeking solace in the bottle more than in the Bible. Passing by a small church, she felt a sudden urge to go inside and speak to the minister. He listened as she recounted her troubles, then asked, "Did you ever think about thanking God for your problems?" The surprising question struck a deep chord with Wilkin. As soon as she got home, she sat down at the piano and sang through her tears, "One day at a time, sweet Jesus, that's all I'm asking of you. Just give me the strength to do every day what I have to do." She grabbed an envelope and scrawled a few more lyrics. The next day, she called her friend, Chris Christopherson, to help her finish the song. First recorded by Marilyn Sellers, "One Day at a Time" peaked as a top 40 hit on the pop charts and a top 20 on country. It won a Dove Award for Song of the Year from Gospel Music Association in 1975, the same year Wilkin was inducted into the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame. 50 years later, Mary John Wilkins' heartfelt plea for God's help continues to touch all who hear it. New beginnings. Was my daughter's spinal surgery too important to leave in God's hands? Anna's Peace by Gloria Joyce, Willow Grove, Pennsylvania. The salesperson at the cell phone store went over the options that came free with my plan. I barely registered a word he said. I had a lot more on my mind than replacing a broken phone. I'll take this one, I said, pointing to a phone identical to my 13-year-old daughter, Anna's. The salesperson hustled to the back to get my selection. Anna took my hand and squeezed it. It'll be fine, Mom. You'll see. I nodded and forced a smile. I knew Anna was talking about her upcoming spinal surgery. These past few weeks, I hadn't been able to hide how worried I was. I pulled my baby girl close, wishing I could somehow absorb her faith that God would watch over her. But this surgery was too important, too risky for me to blindly trust God. After all, he'd let me down before. Anna had been born brimming with joy and energy. She was as inquisitive and determined as a teen as she had been as a toddler. She liked to ask questions and forge her own path. She loved learning and sharing her reasoning, yet she didn't let reason get in the way of belief. She'd accomplish things with her hand firmly in God's, as I'd taught her. I wanted Anna and her older sister Cassie to have a strong relationship with God. Me, I needed to see God working to believe he was there, especially where my girls were concerned. Doubt and worry were my constant companions, like when Anna turned 7 and I first heard her name and the word scoliosis in the same sentence. I had noticed her shoulder blade seemed off one day when we were swimming at the YMCA. One shoulder blade protruded farther when she bent down. I asked her doctor about it at Anna's annual well visit, and she referred us to Dr. Greenhill, a pediatric orthopedist. Dr. Greenhill diagnosed Anna with scoliosis, a sideway curvature of her spine. We'll just watch it and see what her back does as she grows, he told us at our first appointment. Some spinal curvatures correct on their own. It's too early to worry. But worry I did. When I was growing up, scoliosis had caused one of my relatives a great deal of suffering. Anna took her diagnosis in stride. She blissfully went about her childhood, barely pausing, even as her appointments with her orthopedist increased from twice to 4 times a year. From ages 11 to 13, Anna was required to wear a chest-to-hip brace for 23 hours a day, but she didn't let it get her down. I'd prayed that the brace would help her avoid surgery, but Anna's preteen growth spurt drastically increased her spinal curvature. At her most recent orthopedist appointment, a little more than a month ago, we got in the news I'd been dreading. Anna's spine requires immediate correction, Dr. Greenhill said. Without surgery, her spinal column may begin to press on her lungs, decreasing their capacity. But unlike most surgeons, I don't recommend a full spinal fusion. I breathed a sigh of relief. My relative had undergone a full spinal fusion in her teens to correct her scoliosis, and the resulting loss of flexibility had limited her mobility and crushed her spirit. I couldn't bear the thought of that happening to my active, happy-go-lucky girl. Dr. Greenhill explained that he could perform an operation in which only the thoracic part of the spine, the section above the rib cage that naturally was limited range of motion, would be fused. In nearly every case, this allows the lower spine to correct, so there's no loss of mobility. Nearly every case. My mind stuck on those words. What if it doesn't self-correct, I asked. Then Anna would need another surgery, Dr. Greenhill said. But honestly, I believe this is her best choice. Her case is textbook. There's every reason to be optimistic. Mom, I want to try, Anna said. Besides, if it works for me, it could encourage other kids who need this operation. God's got this. We scheduled the surgery for mid-April 2021. 2 months later, I grew more anxious with each passing day. I blame God for making Anna face this trial. Why couldn't he have answered my prayers and used the brace to correct her scoliosis? My relationship with God was complicated. Growing up, I'd been told he was my heavenly father whose love for me was boundless. I struggled with that concept because I didn't feel loved by my earthly father. My dad never raised a hand to me, but his hurtful words tore at my self-esteem. It wasn't until after I left home at 19 that I learned about emotional abuse and the damage it can do to a person on the inside, where the bruises don't show. I went to counseling and worked hard to break the unhealthy patterns I'd grown up with. I married Matt, a kind, loving man who was devoted to our family. Yet I still had trust issues. I distanced myself from God the way I distanced myself from my dad after I left home. God hadn't been there to protect me when I'd been at my most vulnerable. How could I trust that he would be there for Anna? It wasn't lost on me that I taught her and her sister to believe in what I could not. I yearned for that kind of faith. Like I said, things between me and God were complicated. I marveled at how Anna leaned into God. She prayed fervently as she prepped for the surgery and its year-long recovery. She asked others to pray for her as well. She even adopted a new practice of praying the Chaplet of Divine Mercy, a group of prayers prayed on rosary beads to obtain mercy. A few short weeks after we went to the cell phone store, Anna and I went to the hospital for her surgery. Because of COVID restrictions, only one family member was allowed to accompany her. I promised to update Matt and Cassie frequently via my new phone. Anna and I waited in the pre-op room together. She led us in prayer, and I blessed her forehead just before she was rolled away. I managed to hold it together until she rounded the corner to the operating room. A nurse saw me crying and gave me a hug. "There's a chapel downstairs," she said. "Let me tell you where to find it." Dazedly, I followed her directions. My mind flashed the memory of Anna as a young girl, one I hadn't thought of in years. She was sitting on the kneeler in church, using the pews as a desk, meticulously coloring pictures of Jesus and the saints where scripture was read. Almost immediately after the homily, she would fall asleep. Nearly every Sunday, I processed for communion with the sleeping Anna in my arms. One day, I asked her about it. "Church makes me peaceful because God is there," she said. "It's like he's holding me." I'd taken only a few steps into the small hospital chapel when all at once I felt a profound peace envelope me. The peace Anna had discovered when she was a little girl. I dropped to my knees. Why had it taken me this long to let God fully into my heart? "Lord, I'm so sorry for not trusting you," I prayed. "Please hold your child's hand today. Send your angels to be with her so she's not alone." A short while later, I walked back to the surgical lobby. My phone vibrated with a text. "How you holding up, Mama?" my friend Mike wrote. Another text came. "My best friend Chris, lifting you in prayer." Then another from my husband. "Sending you a hug, my love." Ping, ping, ping. Prayers, jokes, reminders to eat, mental health checks. One by one, everyone Anna had asked to pray for her reached out to me, letting me know I was not alone. I couldn't help but notice the double meaning in God's answer to my prayer in the chapel for Anna. I too was his beloved child. My earthly father had let me down, but my heavenly father would always be there for me. I leaned into his strength while I waited. Midway through the operation, my phone pinged with an unexpected text from Anna. She must have scheduled it to arrive at just this moment. "Hi, Mom. My surgery should be halfway finished. I just wanted you to know that I love you and God's got this." "Hi, sweetheart," I texted back. "The nurses say you are doing great. I'm right here holding your hand, and so is God. He's got this." With each update I received, I texted Anna. I told her about all the people who had texted me to say they were praying for her, sharing their encouragement in real time. Though she wouldn't be able to read the messages for hours, I knew God would make sure the strength and love in them got through. 8 hours after Anna was wheeled into the operating room, Dr. Greenhill came to tell me that Anna was in recovery. The surgery had gone as planned, but it would be another year before we would know how her lower spine would respond. The months flew by. Anna's activity was restricted as she healed and went into physical therapy, but she remained her positive, buoyant self. The following April, Anna and I sat in Dr. Greenhill's office, eager to discover how things had progressed with her spine. "Just as I thought, textbook perfect," he said. "No more restrictions on physical activity. Go have a blast. What's the first thing you want to do?" "Go ziplining," Anna said, giving Dr. Greenhill a high five. "Want to see your new back?" he asked, pulling up her latest x-ray on his computer. "Look, Mom," Anna said, leaning toward the screen. This time, I already knew God was working. I didn't need to see it to believe. Everyday Blessings, Forgotten Gifts by Sabra Ciccanelli, Editor. The slow death of our television began with an alert that flashed across the screen one night. This function is not available now. I tried cleaning the remote control, unplugging the TV, updating the system. Nothing worked. I thought about getting a new TV, but we didn't have the budget to replace it. I spent hours online researching our 12-year-old model and concluded that my motherboard was on its way out. Motherboard. That word held significance. I heard it as two words. Mother, board. With my younger son Henry away at college, my role as a mom had taken a big turn. I was still navigating the change. I was stressed, and if I was being completely honest with myself, a little bored. I had just resumed watching Jeopardy after dinner. It was bittersweet to watch Henry's favorite show alone, but now the annoying alert blotted out the show's clues and answers. My usual routine for winding down was ruined. I prayed the TV would mysteriously fix itself. Instead, the alerts came more frequently as the week went on. Frustrated, I decided to settle down with a book instead. I scanned my bookcase and found a historical novel that I'd been given as a gift a few years ago and never read. The first few nights, restless thoughts distracted me. I fought the urge to pick up my phone and research new TVs or check social media. Once I got lost in the story about a widow on a ship in the early 19th century, everything changed. A new level of relaxation opened and a deep sense of peace spilled into my day and even my night's sleep. We moved our broken TV out of the living room and have yet to replace it. Now when I think about that stubborn alert, I feel grateful. What I saw as a problem was really an invitation to make space for something better. I suppose blessings sometimes find their way into our lives disguised as problems, and the answer isn't always getting something new, but rediscovering gifts we already have. That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.